In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Associated Press economics reporter Chris Rugaber discusses the Federal Reserve's projections on interest rates and outlook for the U.S. economy. Then, Lev Fasher, correspondent for the health news website Stat News, discusses his year-long investigation into opioid addiction in the United States. Plus, a closer look at the political turmoil rocking Haiti with Queens College political science professor François Pierre-Louis.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
We begin with a discussion of Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell's comments this week on the outlook for the U.S. economy and future interest rate cuts.
Chris Rugaber is at our table this morning, the economics and Federal Reserve reporter for the Associated Press, here to talk about the Federal Reserve's action yesterday, or at least their news conference.
Right.
Headline, Federal Reserve still foresees three interest rate cuts this year despite bump in inflation. What did the board decide?
Well, they didn't decide to do a lot yesterday, but the news sort of was, as you said, that they decided to keep the three rate cut forecast for this year. And that was a little bit up in the air because there have been a couple of inflation reports that showed prices are still rising a bit faster than they would like to see, and that probably most Americans would like to see. And so the concern was whether they would continue to pencil in those rate cuts, which, they're looking at cutting rates as inflation does come down. Inflation has come down a lot from the peaks of summer 2022. So there's a little worry, particularly on Wall Street, that they might pull back some of those forecasted rate cuts. But Chair Jerome Powell made clear that while they're a little worried about some of this uptick in inflation in the past couple of months, they think the story is still the same, as he put it, and that they will be able to cut rates later this year.
Why are they a little bit concerned and not overly concerned? Where did they see inflation tick up?
Well, you saw it tick up in January and February. Some of it was in rental prices and other housing costs. Some of it was in other services, such as car insurance is still a big thing. You have, more expensive cars. Car prices went up a lot during this inflationary episode. So now the cost to insure them is rising. But I think they felt like Chair Powell suggested that some of this was a temporary uptick or a seasonal adjustment with the numbers, and that in the coming months we should see inflation come back down a bit in terms of the growth of consumer prices coming down to the lower levels that we saw in the second half of last year, which is what gave them the optimism that they might be able to cut this year.
What was the reaction from Wall Street?
Oh, it was very positive. You saw the indexes, all three major indexes, closed at record highs. Again, as there was this reassurance that they will cut, and of course, lower interest rates in general can help stock prices, can help company profits to some degree. And so, yes, share prices went up a lot yesterday as soon as that press conference, during the press conference and after.
What happens when the Federal Reserve starts lowering, it starts making cuts to the interest rates?
Well, typically and over time, it should help consumers. You should see lower mortgage rates. You should see lower rates on auto loans. Maybe even credit card rates, which are near record highs, should come down. So that's a benefit to consumers. And business loans also should be a little easier to get, a little cheaper. So it could give a little bit of a boost to the economy and keep growth. The economy is growing now. We have low unemployment. So hopefully that if they are able to implement those rate cuts, that would keep that economy growing the way it is now.
Has Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve Board landed this plane and avoided a recession?
Well, so far, yes. I mean, that seems to be what is happening, and that's very good news. It's not what was expected at the end. If you go back to 2022, late 2022, inflation was still very high, and there was an expectation that the Fed would have to raise rates so high that they would cause a recession, that the higher interest rates would cause people to pull back on spending so much that we would have a downturn. And instead, even as they did raise rates, consumers continued to spend. There were certainly some pullbacks in areas like housing. Home sales fell. Car sales did so-so. But overall, the economy continued to grow. People, companies continued to hire. And so, right, there's hope that, the so-called soft landing, where we would get inflation back down to the Fed's 2% target without a recession, so far we're on track for that.
What about food prices?
Right.
If there are, is there anything the Federal Reserve can do about food prices and the uptick that consumers have seen since the pandemic?
Right. Not probably much more than they have been able to do so far. I mean, food prices are, grocery prices are as much as 25% higher than they were before the pandemic. So even though the increases have come down, in fact, in the past year, they're only up around 1%, but that's still a lot higher than, 3-4 years ago. What we have seen is consumers pushing back a bit. Some of the big food companies have talked about that they raised prices a fair amount in the past couple of years, and they've seen some of their sales drop off. People have gone more to private label. They've gone to discount stores. And so some of the bigger companies, Kraft Heinz, Procter & Gamble, people like that, also in consumer goods, have talked about not being able to raise prices as much this year. Now, there may still be a little bit of a hike, but there is evidence that that is slowing down. And the hope is that people will continue to get pay raises. On average, in the past year or so, Americans on average have gotten some wage increases that outpace the price hikes. But I think a lot of people will still need to see a few more raises to feel like they've caught up. But that's the hope. You know, bringing prices actually back down is something that usually only happens in a very bad recession, and we don't really want that.
So they're not talking about lowering prices. They're talking about not raising as much because we're not in a recession.
Right. That's right. And the hope, even though wage increases are slowing as well, which does reduce some of the inflationary pressure, wages on average are still rising a bit faster than they were before the pandemic. And so as that continues, the goal is for people to feel that they can afford a lot of this stuff more back to where something close to where it was before.
That was Chris Rugaber, who covers the economy and Federal Reserve for the Associated Press. Next, a closer look at opioid addiction in the U.S. and what's being done to fight it.
Joining us from New York is Lev Fasher. He is with the New Service Stat. He is an addiction correspondent here to talk about his new series, The War on Recovery, which you can find online at statnews.com. Mr. Fasher, thanks for giving us your time.
Thanks for having me, and happy anniversary to C-SPAN.
Thank you very much. A little bit about STAT. How would you describe it to other people? How are you financially supported?
We are a health and medicine news site run under the same media umbrella as the Boston Globe Company, but largely supported by subscribers to our premium service, STAT Plus. So if folks are interested in premium, you know, health, life sciences, biopharma content, statnews.com. And we also, of course, do a lot of general news coverage of these important topics for a much broader audience as well.
You write a lot about addiction in the United States, but the latest series takes a look at the idea of recovery. The War on Recovery is how you titled it. How did you get interested in this topic?
Right. So in my role as STAT's addiction reporter, I really want to drill down on what is going wrong in the United States, because obviously we are not handling our drug crisis very well. We have about 105,000-110,000 people dying each year of drug overdoses. Over 80,000 of those are opioid overdoses. And the premise of this series that you mentioned, The War on Recovery, is essentially that we have two really effective medications that are known to reduce risk of dying of opioid overdose by about half. And instead of doing everything we can to get these medications into the hands of people who need them. We, in many cases as a country, do the opposite. We make them really difficult to access. We place a lot of restrictions on their use. So these medications are called methadone and buprenorphine. People may also know buprenorphine by its brand name, Suboxone. So that's the premise of the series, really, that at many different levels of American society, we are restricting access to medications known to prevent overdose death. And of course, with over 80,000 people dying of overdose, that's something that needs to happen urgently.
Let's start with the drugs themselves. How do they work?
Essentially, methadone and buprenorphine are both weak opioids, so to speak. So you can think of it a little bit as like a nicotine patch or nicotine gum for someone who's trying to not smoke cigarettes anymore. Essentially, if you try to stop using illicit opioids like heroin or fentanyl or even a prescription painkiller, if you just stop cold turkey, you're going to experience really agonizing, debilitating withdrawal symptoms. It's actually going to be so severe that almost no one successfully does it. That was already true in the age of heroin, and now that the drugs people are buying on the street are almost entirely this ultra-potent fentanyl, it's doubly true. It's all but impossible to just quit opioids cold turkey. So these medications essentially come in and they bind to the receptors in your brain, the same receptors as heroin or fentanyl. But they don't get people high if they're administered properly. For someone with addiction who's just trying to stop using illicit substances, the idea is that these medications leave them clear-headed and able to function, free of withdrawal symptoms, and also free to just go about their life as family members or students or employees or, you know, anything else.
You said if they're administered properly, typically how are they administered as a treatment for opioid addiction?
Right. So methadone is a very restricted medication when used to treat opioid addiction. It's actually only available as an addiction treatment at a specialized methadone clinic. And in many cases, these clinics require their patients to come in every day to receive a single dose. So essentially, you're structuring your life around the requirement to be at this clinic every morning. And in recent years, a lot of clinics have grown more lenient and have given more what are called take-home doses. So they'll give you 3 days or a week or even 2 weeks of medication to take home, keep in your fridge, you know, in little liquid bottles. But for the most part, people who go to methadone clinics, they have to comply with quite a lot of restrictions and logistics in a way that a lot of public health experts at this point believe is harmful to their recovery, because obviously you want to be able to have a source of income and a stable living situation and a stable family situation. And, you know, any of us who wake up and go to work every morning can only imagine how difficult it would be if we added this requirement of going to a medical clinic at 6 or 7 a.m. every day. So that's methadone. And then buprenorphine is much simpler. That one, it has fewer risks associated with its use. So you can essentially get it prescribed by most doctors, and you can pick up the prescription at a pharmacy like most medications.
Mr. Fascher, that first part of The War on Recovery is found online. And in it, you write, it's conscious choices that are being made to keep these drugs from people. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. So there are many different levels of American society that in some ways work harder to deny these medications to people who need them than to provide access to them. A few examples. Until very recently, doctors required a special license to prescribe buprenorphine, even though any doctor who was a licensed prescriber could, of course, prescribe patients highly addictive painkillers like OxyContin or other opioid painkillers. So even though there was a much safer, much weaker medication used to treat addiction that those painkillers could sometimes actually cause themselves, doctors had to jump through additional hoops to get a special license just to prescribe the medication treatment. That's one example. I already mentioned the restrictions surrounding methadone clinics and how difficult it can be to receive methadone care. One interesting example, a nuanced example though, is that of Narcotics Anonymous, which is the 12-step program modeled largely after Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want to paint with too broad a brush because there's been an evolution here and different meetings, different chapters are very different from one to the next. But in many, many cases, Narcotics Anonymous meetings and actually the organization's literature at a national level oppose the use of these medications, even though they are essentially the best tool we have to help people stop using illicit opioids and prevent them from dying of opioid overdoses. There's a view that people who use these medications aren't clean or aren't fully abstinent from drugs or aren't in true recovery, but addiction doctors and many people who use these medications as part of their recovery would essentially tell you that they've given them their life back and they are happy and thriving thanks to these medications. So there's a lot of stigma, there's a lot of discrimination to this day that people who take these medications face.
That group that you mentioned, Narcotics Anonymous, they have on their website something called Bulletin Number 29. It reads in part this, saying members on drug replacement programs such as methadone are encouraged to attend NA meetings. But this raises the question, does NA have the right to limit members' participations in meetings? We believe so. While some groups choose to allow such members to share, it is also common practice for NA groups to encourage these members or any other addict who is still using to participate only by listening and by talking with members after the meeting or during the break. This is not meant to alienate or embarrass. This is only meant to preserve an atmosphere of recovery in our meetings. There's more that's said on the website, but I saw that one part. But you said, and you did say it was a nuanced approach. Can you elaborate in light of that?
Well, I just didn't want to cast every single Narcotics Anonymous meeting in quite the same light because there are many that are increasingly supportive of this approach, which is known as medication-assisted treatment. But, you know, in the language you just cited, I heard the phrase still using, I believe. And I think that's very telling in terms of the phenomenon we're discussing because, of course, there's a huge difference between, you know, smoking fentanyl that you buy on the street or injecting it and, you know, waking up in the morning and taking, a pill or a sublingual film that is approved by the FDA and manufactured under really tight regulations by a pharmaceutical company and is very safe and you know exactly what's in it. You know, those two things are clearly just not the same, and one is unfortunately likely to kill you, and one is likely to help enable your recovery and enable you to go about life as anybody else can. So, you know, that's not just Narcotics Anonymous. That's more broadly true. People view these medications as just another form of addiction sometimes. Tom Price, who was President Donald Trump's first health secretary, actually kind of infamously referred to medication-assisted treatment as substituting one opioid for another, which, you know, in a technical, in a medical sense, is true. But at the same time, again, obviously taking an FDA-approved regulated medication is far, far safer and allows you to just live a happier, healthier life than you know, using fentanyl several times a day. So that is an attitude that remains pretty pervasive throughout American society.
That was Lev Fasher, addictions correspondent for the health news site Stat News. Finally, Queens College political science professor Francois Pierre-Louis discusses the political turmoil in Haiti and the humanitarian crisis unfolding there.
When you see the current events that are going on in Haiti, how would you say did we get here?
Well, it's a long history, but we should start maybe in beginning in 2016, when the former president, Michel Martelly, left office and not having held any parliamentary and municipal elections. So the country went into a chaotic situation and he had to be replaced by a provisional president who held elections for Jovenel Moïse. That election was contested by the oppositions and the many members of the population because you did not have a lot of large participation of electors in the election. And then Moïse also did not hold any parliamentary elections, nor municipal elections. So by the time he was assassinated in 2021, the country basically was running without any elected officials, any legitimate government to administer things. So in 2021, the United States supported the installation of Ariel Henry as the interim prime minister. And Mr. Henry was supposed to hold elections within a short period of time, but it's been 3 years and he did not hold any elections. Meanwhile, the gangs began to invade the Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, and many provinces also. They became practically the de facto rulers of Haiti. You had a lot of crimes being committed, guns coming in, all the state institutions were basically non-functioning. So therefore, you end up in a very chaotic and non-functioning state in Haiti, and it has gotten worse now.
The United Nations tells us that because of the situation there, 362,000 people are internally displaced within the country, 5.5 million needing of humanitarian assistance. And you talked about those gang issues in 2023. There were 5,600 gang-related incidents, including over 3,000 killings, over 1,200 kidnappings. Tell us more about these gangs. We hear the term gang, but tell us a little bit about who makes them up.
Well, first, the gangs originally were security guards or protective force for many of the businesses in Haiti. This is how they protected their businesses. This is also how they squash any kind of opposition from the population, protests from members of the civil society who wanted to have a better society in Haiti. And the gangs also came were federated. In fact, the U.S. government encouraged the federation of these gangs, hoping that maybe that was a way they could control them. But instead of controlling them, they went out of order in the sense that no one could control them anymore. You had, Haiti has always been a transshipment for drugs going to the United States. So between the gangs controlling the territory and controlling the drug trafficking, you had more guns coming into the Haiti. Many of those guns were coming directly from the United States. And there was a lot of protests, especially by the UN, giving out reports asking for the U.S. to curb down the gun trafficking in Haiti. But this did not happen. So the gangs eventually because they were being supported by the politicians, they had the state money to function. They used kidnappings and extortions to get other forms of money. So basically, they were loose. No one had control over them anymore. And that's how they ended up controlling the capital. And the fact that the judicial system is very corrupt and punitive ends in Haiti. So you end up having the gangs controlling the most of the capital.
And when it comes to the discussion about gangs, there's a man at the center of that gets quoted often. He goes by the nickname Barbecue. Who is he?
Barbecue was a police officer. He was very closely allied with Michel Martelly and also other government that came in, like Jovenel Moïse. So he was basically sanctioned by the government to go out there and terrorize the population in the slum areas. So Barbecue was made by members of the government as a way to make sure that they can keep the population in check. Barbecue also control a large part of the slum in Bel Air and in the northern part of Port-au-Prince. And many of the members that are in the gangs were either police officers or people closely aligned with the police, because the guns, the support that he was getting, came basically from the official members of the government. Therefore, it's not just one person that just came out of the slums. He was a well-trained police officer working on behalf of the Martelly administration and the Jovenel administration. And eventually they empowered him to become the gang leader that he is today.
That was Francois Pierre-Louis, a political science professor at Queens College at the City University of New York. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.